No, we aren't televangelists, but if you would like to support our ministry, send us your filthy lucre by going to the Rational Faith's blog and leaving us a tax-free donation.
If what I have said about sowing and reaping is just for Mike Murdoch's personal gain, may a curse be on me and my ministry, and may my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth.
Rational Faith's Podcast.
Hello, podcast listeners. Welcome to another episode of Rational Face podcast series called Racism 101. I am Miguel, and today my co-host is Thomas Hatton.
Thomas, hi everybody.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and why I would have you. Oh, yeah. Tell about your what you've studied in college and stuff, so people can kind of get an idea where we're going with all this.
Okay, so my first job in college, well, I was doing a part-time job and I was studying at the same time, but my job was teaching migrant farm workers through the high school equivalency program, which is part of this federal fund that provides educational opportunities for migrant farm workers. From there, I started working for this. I graduated from college, and then I started working for the Migrant Education Program, which is a Title I program that came through the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, and I worked in about 11 counties in southeastern Kentucky with migrant kids, so children of migrant farm workers, as well as H-2A workers, and we can talk a little bit about that down the line if you don't know what that is, who are 18 and younger. And then in about year one and a half of working for migrant education, I decided to get my master's degree from the Martin School of Public Policy and Administration. And my thesis was on the migrant education program. And I won't go too into it because it's pretty boring. But I had a lot of experiences that were really eye-opening working with migrant farm workers, and it's farm worker rights are something that I'm really passionate about and something that I still read about and think about. And so I think that's why you asked me on.
You are correct. Hey, so yeah. Explain to me what Title I means, because I don't know about these things. So when you say it's a Title I, and it was part of the some act about education, kind of explain
right
to me,
and I don't want to butcher it. No. Your listeners may know better than I do, but Title I, Lyndon Johnson, when he's president, there was actually this documentary that came out with Edgar Murrow's, you know, that guy from Good Night and Good Luck, famous investigative journalist, and
that's where that saying comes from that people say sometimes, probably.
Yeah, so okay. He did this documentary right before Thanksgiving called Harvest of Shame, and it was about migrant farm workers and just the abysmally bad circumstances in which they lived. At the time, it wasn't all Hispanic farm workers. There were a lot of African American, a lot of Western and Northern European descendancy. But the circumstances that showed in the movie were really shocking. And some of the revelations, like the fact that a lot of the kids weren't in school, were really shocking to people. So as part of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of, I think, 1965 it was, they decided kind of to ride the wave, the policy window that opened up by this documentary, to include migrant children as part of one of these Title I programs. So Title I is kind of like an overarching thing that helps students that are in unusual circumstances, like disabilities or kids who are gifted or just kids that aren't, you know, your typical students. So they provide extra money and funding for certain types of students or certain circumstances that students are in.
Oh, so that's an interesting history. That's really interesting. Yeah.
So they're actually around the same time. This is slightly related, but there was also a grant that was given through the Migrant Health Act in 1962, which was a bunch of money was allocated to different health centers, like community health centers, to help migrant farm workers with health, because along with education, health was another area that migrant farm workers were sort of neglected in, and remain to this day. Migrants as a group, migrant farm workers as a group, are the least educated group as far as like a demographic, and have the worst health problems per capita of any group, I guess, or classification of worker. So,
oh geez.
But both of those, it was fascinating just kind of thinking of the power of, I guess just the shock that can happen from a documentary. You know, all these people are right before Thanksgiving, like they're all about to enjoy this meal with all these fruits and vegetables and all that stuff. And then they look and they see that was picked by like a 10-year-old kid who doesn't get to go to school. And they're like, oh man, kind of helps you get a lot of perspective. It was really shocking for a lot of people.
Yeah. Oh crap. Wow. Let's see. We had discussed before we started recording kind of where we should take this, and so you were going to tell us a little bit about just kind of like did we say more on like the living conditions or just the day-to-day life of a migrant farm worker?
Either works. One of the things I like to talk about when I talk to my friends or family members about migrant farm workers, it's just a meditation. I had a friend who would say a prayer before every meal and would always make sure to bless. You know how Mormons always say, like, bless the hands that prepared this?
Oh, yeah.
They always made sure to bless the hands that picked the food they were going to eat. So think that there's, like, this chain of people from all over the world, really, that made it so you could eat the food that you do. Like, next time you go to the store and you see all the fruits and vegetables in that entire section, it's just a really, I mean, we're so removed from the whole agricultural process that it's kind of a shock to realize that every single vegetable, every single fruit that you see in there was picked by a human being. And it could have been 100 degrees outside and they could have just like hated every second. But they did that, and now you're eating what kind of the fruits of their labor. So I don't know. I think that's a really important meditation to think about when we start to think about farm workers. It's just, you know, at what cost, you know, that every single Kroger or every single Aldi's or every single store with fruit and vegetables, like, is stocked with stuff that people had to pick themselves.
That is a lot to think about, because it's so far removed from us here in Medford. You know how some LDS stakes will have I don't know, like a cannery or something like that. We have big pear orchards where at about a 4-stake area they come and they'll pick the pears off of that, and then the church does something with it with their welfare program. And so we only go for like an hour, right?
Yeah.
And I go when it's a little bit cooler, if I go at all.
Right.
You know. So it's pretty plush. All right. Well, let's keep going where you want to go with this.
So yeah, just a couple demographic stuff just to kind of start us off. There are about 3 million farm workers nationwide. There may be more or less, but and 3/5 of them travel. So a migrant farm worker is somebody who travels from one area to another. If they just work locally, they're not necessarily in other words, if they stay in the same city or the same town for the entire season and just pick when it's time, then they're called seasonal workers. But if they migrate, they're called migrant workers. So 3 million farm workers nationwide, and 3/5 travel from one area to another for seasonal crop patterns. Just to give you an idea of the, on our phone conversation we had, I talked about there how there are three streams. There's a western stream, which begins in Southern California and travels up along the west coast, which is probably up to where you are. Then there's the Midwestern stream, which begins in Texas and actually doesn't go up to any one specific state, just sort of disperses all throughout the entire United States. Hmm. And there's the Eastern stream, which begins in Florida, which has a lot of, you know, oranges and different things like that, and then goes all the way up to Maine, Pennsylvania, Northeast and stuff. Hmm. So there are three distinct streams by which typically migrant farm workers have traveled. But now that agriculture has changed, a lot of automation has changed the way farm work is done. The streams have become a lot more haphazard. So it's not so like predictable where work will come next. So when I used to work for migrant education, we would be in a barn sometime, like waiting for tobacco workers, and they'd say, well, you know, we got some people coming from Michigan, you know, so they'd be coming down the stream just because, I mean, it's crazy. They heard that there was work in Kentucky, so a bunch of people got into a van and traveled hundreds of miles to work in Kentucky in tobacco in the middle of the season. Like, so things have gotten a lot more, I think, tough for certain migrants just because, like, the work is changing.
So, you know, is there, like, I'm trying to figure, what are they doing in Texas? I mean, because I did my mission in Dallas, so I'm just thinking, what the crap are they growing in Texas?
Well, the guys that I knew that worked in Texas, they talk about all sorts of things being grown in Texas. Like, pretty much anything you can imagine. They talked about these big farms, watermelons, and all sorts of things. It would obviously depend on the area. I used to live in Texas, so I know what you mean. You know, you're going through those large stretches of just desert, and you're just like, there's no life anywhere. If my car stops, I'm dead. I'm going to be eaten by a vulture. But yeah, Texas, there's actually a lot of agriculture in Texas. If I remember correctly, and I could be way off, but I think it's one of the biggest farm work states the country.
Okay.
I might want to fact check that later.
Yeah.
But I think the biggest, what would you guess the biggest would be?
Well, I would guess California, and specifically I would guess the Central Valley of California, but I could be way off.
California, Florida, Texas are the big players, if I remember correctly.
Huh, interesting. That's really interesting about Texas. Shows you how ignorant I am with this. With this stuff. And then why the heck do they go up on the east side? Why the heck do they go up? What's in Maine? Is that cranberries? I mean, I'm just thinking of like those cranberry commercials.
I would really have to check. It's been a while since I've done that work, but we used to get crop calendars for different states.
Oh, really?
It's just always interesting to see what was grown here and there, because like greenhouses allow for anything to be grown at any time. So
true. That is true. Yeah.
Sometimes like in, you know, Michigan or something like that, or Wisconsin, they'll have these huge, huge, huge greenhouses with all sorts of fruits and vegetables there. So, yeah. Okay. There's something else I was going to mention. I don't remember.
It's all right. And is the population of farm workers, is it pretty evenly distributed? You know, the, what did you call it? The West, what was it called? The Western flow. What did you call that? You know, California
and stream. They call it streams.
Stream. So the Western stream, and then you know the Midwest stream, and then the East stream. Are they kind of pretty much divided evenly among those three streams, or do you see more?
I can't remember off the top of my head, but what I was going to say that I had forgotten was just to contextualize the work I did. I live in Kentucky. And the primary work that's done in Kentucky that people qualify on for migrant programs is tobacco work. So they work in tobacco, which is a crop that's almost all year round. And then the reason why I bring up the qualification thing is because there are a lot of horse workers too, which horse work is not considered by a lot of these programs as actual migrant work, even though people come to work with horses and travel. Like, they view it for, there are a lot of reasons for it. Some, and they're very political, and there's a lot of bureaucracy in between, but for some reason, horse work doesn't, like, working with horses doesn't count as working with, like, livestock and stuff like that. So, anyway, that's a whole different topic of conversation.
That's weird, man. So when you say horse work, what do you mean? Are they, like, horseshoeing? Are they feeding the animals, or all of the above?
In Kentucky, there's a huge horse industry that pretty much runs central Kentucky. It's Lexington, Kentucky, where I used to live, is called the horse capital of the world. And there are all these million-dollar, billion-dollar farms. And there are people that walk the horses, there are people that sire the horses, people that feed the horses, all that stuff. And it doesn't matter if they came there from somewhere else, they're not considered migrant farm workers, even if they're migrating and working on a farm, just because of policy and a bunch of other reasons, which would probably take its own whole podcast to really unpack.
That's crazy. It's like that never even crossed my mind that, you know, that would be something that a migrant, I guess you're saying they don't count as migrant, but I guess an immigrant, documented or undocumented, would be doing. Yeah, that's fascinating. Tell us, you know, you and I had a conversation about tobacco and kind of the labor that takes. And of course, me living in the Northwest, once again, something I had, you know, no idea about. And it was fascinating for me.
Well, tobacco, I think one of the things that might be worth mentioning now is that agricultural industry is among the most dangerous industries. So I read this report from the Department of Labor that said it was the most dangerous industry of all. And just to think of some of the reasons why, a lot of people are out in the sun all day. So this is just generalizable anywhere. Sorry, I didn't answer your question directly, but I feel like it might be good to have some context.
Yeah, for sure.
A lot of people are exposed to sun all day and don't have adequate skin covering. They're exposed to toxic chemicals, pesticides. The conditions in which they work are not very agreeable a lot of the time. Dehydration's a problem. So having said that, tobacco itself is a deadly crop. There's this thing called green tobacco sickness, which you can get in certain circumstances, and it'll pretty much put you out for the entire day. It's like a horrible flu with diarrhea, vomiting, all this horrible stuff.
Just from the tobacco plant itself?
Yeah, from the plant itself. You should look it up. It's, yeah, just touching it without, you know, the proper protection. My former boss told the story of these guys from the north. It was a northern state. I don't remember where it was, but they had come down to work in tobacco. They didn't know how to work in tobacco. Tobacco is a very labor intensive and a very specialized plant to work with. And these guys just heard, oh, there's work and it pays pretty good, so you just come on down. So they all came on down. These guys had never worked in tobacco before. And a guy got some tobacco juice in his eye. And he said his eye was just like bugging out, like bloodshot, like inflamed, just totally disgusting. And he was pretty much out of work for the rest of the day because he was just, you know, his eye was just burning. So first of all, tobacco is just like this big, deadly plant. And I'll give you a little bit of the cycle. You plant it early in the year. You put it in these seed beds and you go out and plant the seed beds in these fields. They grow. The plant matures and it gets pretty big. It can get up to like a few feet tall. And you, after it grows, you have to do some trimming of different parts. But then you go out there with a hatchet and you chop it down and then you put it on the spike behind you. So there are these tobacco spikes, which can be metal or wood. A lot of times are wood. So you cut down this gigantic plant and then you put on the spike behind you, this wooden spike behind you. So just right there, the tobacco plant could kill you. You can lop off fingers with your hatchet. And then the spike behind you, when you're trying to put the tobacco on it, I knew at least two people who had their eyes poked out by tobacco spikes. So they lost an eye from you know, if you're just imagining like chopping it down in front of you and then turning around to put on a spike behind you that sometimes somebody else put up, yeah, they get their eye poked out. So then after you chop it, you leave it out and it dries a little bit, and then you go and put it in a big barn, which can be two or three stories. And for every guy that got his eye poked out, there are like five guys that were hanging tobacco on the top of a barn and fell off. So,
oh, shice, dude.
You're at the very top of a barn hanging up tobacco plants, and you know, I'd go in and you'd see guys just like dangling, like with one foot on one board and another foot on another board, and you're just like, you guys, like, this is so dangerous. Crazy thing is, before migrant farm workers, like before a lot of immigrant farm workers did it in Kentucky, it was a lot of local labor, or it was a lot of it was even kids that did it. But there were a lot of laws that kind of stopped that from doing. But there used to be family farms that they'd have tobacco, and just families would participate in it. So it's just pretty crazy how dangerous of a plant it could be, and how it's for many, many years it was just sort of like a pillar of Kentucky agriculture and something that was very kind of connected with Kentucky living, considering how dangerous it was.
That's crazy. And when you say a hatchet, like the base of a tobacco plant, how big is that? Like the size of a mayonnaise jar, or you know, I'm trying to.
Yeah, I would say it isn't huge. Okay. It's a lot smaller than that.
Okay.
If we're going with condiments, probably like a glass ketchup tube.
Okay, there you go.
Maybe a little bigger.
Okay, yeah, that's good.
I wanted to go with your thing there.
No,
you started.
I appreciate it. And then why the spikes?
Because they need to leave them out, and sometimes they'll stack several plants on one spike. So they'll cut down three or four plants, and then they'll put them up on the spike. And
the spike,
it's hard.
And the spike goes through the plant then?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's like a shish kebab then. You can put one on top of the other.
Exactly. Shish kebab. I like that.
That is, that sounds dangerous. And then you were telling me about workman's compensation in Kentucky with this type of stuff.
Yeah, there's this one guy, he was working on a horse farm actually, but he had done some work in tobacco and had lost his eye. And we were trying to do some research on workman's comp for him, and we just discovered that for farm work in Kentucky, there's just no workman's comp for workplace injuries, which we were just like, what the heck? But if you go and read the fine print, like, there's a number of states where, like, you can get severely injured on a job in farm work or in horse work, and you won't get workman's comp, so you're just basically hosed. And as of the time I was working, Kentucky was one of them. So there's been some rumblings of legislation, but it's not a legislative topic that's on the forefront of a lot of people's minds, because farm work in Kentucky has declined significantly for a couple other reasons, which once again could be its own podcast, probably not this one, because it has a lot more to do with economics and you know, other forces and factors. I mean, agriculture is an industry that's just sort of, it runs everything that we do, but nobody ever thinks about it.
Oh, yeah, you just take it for granted, like the food in the grocery store.
Right, and there are all these weird sort of subsidies going on, like, for certain industries, and yeah, it's crazy how much money is floating around in the agricultural sector, but, you know, you don't hear anybody saying, like, we're going to make agriculture great, you know, like, it's just not anything like that. And so peripherally, like, if that's a peripheral item, then migrant farm worker health is like an even more peripheral.
Yeah, it doesn't sell like Make America Great Again, is what you're saying.
It's just, yeah, it's not in like the forefront of any politician's mind to win votes.
Yeah,
like this.
Yeah, for sure. And
which really stinks. It really stinks as like a service worker for that population, because, you know, it was really tough to see people need help and just be powerless to a system that, like, you just don't see changing in the foreseeable future, unless, like, some just really passionate guy gets an office and then is able to convince like state or federal Congress to like act on it. You know, it's just ridiculous. While we're on workplace injuries, it's just sort of a good activity for someone who kind of wants to understand farm work is just to think about any plant. And just think about the process that it takes to harvest it or plant it or whatever else. And just think of the activity that is required to do it. And maybe if you think about like crops that are grown close to you, try to figure out how many a farm worker picks a day or is required to pick a day to meet their quota. And just think about like, because think about picking, like I've grown gardens before and I've helped my dad grow gardens, and you can pretty much pick everything in the garden in less than an hour. But think about picking for like 8 hours for like 5 days a week or 11 hours or whatever. Like just think about the mechanics of it is all I'm saying. Like a fruit tree, like an orange tree. Think about picking hundreds of thousands, like just thousands and thousands of oranges and just like all the things that could happen. I mean, you're a physician, so think about like what could happen to the body if it's doing that repeated motion over and over again, or if it's hunched over in a field, picking, you know, cucumbers or whatever, or, you know, or I guess cucumbers grow up walls, but anyway, you get my point.
Yeah. You know, I remember when I was finishing up school, I did my last rotation was with a clinic that saw a lot of immigrants, and they would do outreach stuff. They would actually go out sometimes to the migrant farm worker camps. But I remember one time going out there, and a woman came and saw us, and she had a brachial plexus injury. And so, to get a little nerdy with you, all the nerves that come out of your neck that go to your arm, they do this weird cross back and forth up right up by the neck, and that's the brachial plexus. So all those nerves give your arm sensation, gives the muscles the ability to do what they do. And she had it from carrying the bag on that shoulder for so long, she had crushed the brachial plexus, so that arm was kind of pretty much useless. You know, from, and it was a, you know, a very short, stout lady that, you know, this was her thing. So I just remember thinking, oh crap, dude. But it's easy to forget about people like this when because they're essentially in the shadows, right? You don't see them. Yeah. So you don't see them, so you don't think about them.
Yeah. So a lot of farm workers are foreign born. A lot of them speak a native language other than English. The great majority are Latino. And there's a large percentage, it's hard to know exact numbers, and there might be a fact sheet somewhere about it, but a lot of them are undocumented. And the ones that are undocumented, like, first of all, they're trying not to get caught. So they're doing something that's very public and out in the open, but they're also trying not to get caught. Like, ICE raids happen all the time on farms and farm trails and stuff like that. So they have this impossible job of, like, having to worry about their own safety, providing a service that's like invaluable, also not being able to like report abuses. I had so many, I just remember hearing so many stories, you know, of these guys that would work, and the farmers knew that these guys were undocumented, and they'd say, oh, hey, you know, we'll pay you at the very end. We don't have the money right now, but we'll pay you at the very end. So these guys would like work for like 3 weeks straight. And then on week four, and everything about like how they would get the guys to the location would be super shady. So they'd like get these guys in the back of a truck that's like closed and take them to a place so they couldn't remember where it was and couldn't remember who it was. And then they just wouldn't pay them. They just disappear on like week four. So they just get all this free labor out of these guys that they knew they could take advantage of. Like, you hear stuff like that, and you're just like, these guys are robber barons. Like, there's this real, it's hard to speak ill of farmers because, you know, farmers are the guys that make it so we can eat food on our table. And when you're talking about policy, like, they're a protected class in the sense that you can't really speak super ill of farmer because people will say, oh, well, farmers are the pillar of our society, which is true. But there's also, you got to get out of your mind, like, the farmer is like this humble, poor guy. Like farmers now, like that own the ranches out where you're at, they're millionaires sometimes. Like they own like millions and millions of acres of land, like so much land. These small farms that used to exist, it's become a much bigger industry, or maybe not that. It's become an industry that like a few people have taken larger control of, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Because here in Southern Oregon, we essentially have three large companies. There's Namis, there's Bear Creek, and I can't remember the other one off the top of my head. But yeah, they're huge, just multi-million dollar companies. So there's a distance, right, between the families that own these large farming companies and, you know, the actual work that gets done. And it's almost with the farmers, to speak ill of them, the sense I get is almost like speaking ill of a nurse. You know, you just don't do that publicly. You know, you know how.
Well, yeah, and the thing is, it's true that without farmers, we'd be screwed. But that doesn't mean that, like, you can't scrutinize, like, bad things that happen on farms. One of the things, interesting things that farmers do a lot of the time, though, is they'll get these contratistas, and they'll basically, and the contratistas sometimes are undocumented themselves, but sometimes they're American citizens, and they'll go and get, like, random people to work every day, so they're not on anybody's payroll, and they'll pay under the table. So they'll like officially pay these guys, and then these guys will unofficially pay these workers. And so they get a random team every day so that they don't have to say, you know, if one of the guys gets hurt, then they don't have to pay him. Or if one of the guys is like a criminal or whatever, they can say, oh, we have no idea who you're talking about. We just pick up random people. So it's just a way. And then the farmer can be, if ICE comes and talks to the farmer, he can just be like, I have no idea who works at my farm day in, day out. Honestly, I just supervise everything like from a distance, and I get my friend out in the field to kind of watch everybody. So that's another way that they kind of create a lot of distance.
Oh my crap. It's almost, I mean, it's not as bad, but it's almost, you know, when during slavery, how, you know, the white slave owner would use another slave to be the one to, you know, either whip, or you had the one that was in the house that was propped up, you know, as being better than the farm hands. You know, oftentimes it was, you know, someone that had a black and a white parent, you know, so they're lighter skinned and stuff. It's not the severity of that, because these people aren't enslaved, but it has that same kind of feeling to me. But you know, it's
it's not like you don't see it. It's just a tough situation for everybody to be put in. I have a fact sheet that says the average median yearly salary for a farm worker is $18,000. So like nobody's getting super rich off of this. In these migrant households, sometimes every single person works in the whole family.
Yeah.
Mother, grandma, grandpa, sometimes everybody will work.
You know, so, and you know, when you were talking about, you know, these people being left, you know, working and then not being paid, I remember this, she wasn't a migrant farm worker, but when I was in Dallas, a woman we had baptized heard of a job where she could go and clean the Coliseum where the Dallas Cowboys play, right? And same thing, she worked for like a week, and then the dude just didn't pay him, and, you know, she had nothing that she could do because she was an undocumented immigrant, right? But she had put all this time into it, and it's, you know, it's pretty pretty terrible. And then the other thing you kind of reminded me of was this is something I'm ashamed to say I just recently learned about, but you know, the hashtag Me Too thing that women have been doing, you know, the stories that you don't hear about are the the stories of the migrant farm workers, you know, the one that gets driven way out, you know, in the middle of an orchard in the Central Valley of California and is told that she has to, you know, the white guy, that you have to, you know, perform whatever sex act for me if you want to get your check. And so the woman in her mind is trying to calculate, okay, if I don't do this, do I have enough money to feed my family for a week, you know, and they're having to do this. And once again, they're in the shadows and often undocumented. And so they have, you know, no recourse often.
Totally. Yeah. And these, I don't know if they have these up in Oregon, but they're these migrant work camps. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah. And that's something I would like to talk, if we have time, about what's going on here in Oregon, but yeah, keep going.
Just when you're talking about, there's some stats about different labor camps. They did some surveys of different labor camps, kind of informal surveys, and they said almost half had witnessed acts of like extreme violence. So like someone being killed or maimed, like, and this is children, by the way. Children had witnessed an extreme act of violence. 10 out of the stats are weird, but some of them had been victims themselves of violence. There's an isolation that happens in the migrant lifestyle, and that makes it really, really tough. And a lot of these kids, because their parents are moving a lot, they have to move with their parents. So, these migrant work camps, there's a lot of health problems that occur there because of unsanitary conditions. Sometimes there's not water available or clean water available. The health outcomes, the UDS data for health outcomes is available for download and, you know, to look at for these community health centers. Or at least it might have been because I was a master's student, but you're able to see just like health outcomes from these migrant farm workers are just, you know, really, really bad. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Part of them is just the nature of their work. And then part of it is the fact that they live in extreme poverty and are exposed to, you know, sort of the side effects of that lifestyle, you know.
Yeah. Well, here in Oregon, there's a couple ways things are set up. So you'll see, I mean, you can sometimes see them from the road, but sometimes they're far enough off where you can't see them. But so for a family, they often live in one, it's like a little cabin that you would rent for the weekend, you know, that has like two bedrooms maybe. Mm-hmm. So they're super tiny. And a lot of them don't have indoor plumbing. The group I work with is called UNETE, and they kind of they advocate for migrant farm worker rights and immigrant rights. So there's this one that I saw where it was in the middle. So it was almost like a plaza in the middle. So you had all the small cabins, right, in a circle. And then in the middle is an outhouse that's communal. Everyone uses that toilet. And then the water is sometimes, you know, brought in a huge container, you know, that gets filled whenever it's empty, and that's what they use to bathe and brush their teeth or, you know, whatever. And then for the single men, they're often a barn has been converted into some type of house. So it's a little bit better than baby Jesus was born into, I guess, but
yeah.
But you know, you see the pictures and there's, you know, well, there's, you know, window panes, but there's no window there, and it's just, or there's cracks everywhere that some of these migrant farm workers have to seal up themselves with, you know, cardboard or duct tape. And the same thing with the homes where the family lives. And for Oregon, the reason that's an issue is the EPA kind of reevaluated pesticide use on farms and orchards. And here in Oregon, we have lots of orchards. They're mostly pear, and we're getting more and more wine vineyards a lot. So a lot of these pear orchards are being pulled out, and then these wine vineyards are being put in. And so EPA said, okay, with these pesticides and herbicides, there has to be this amount of distance between the workers and in the area that's being sprayed. And in Oregon, I don't understand how this happens. Oregon is refusing to use those standards. And so instead of saying like it should be 100 feet, EPA says it should be 100 feet. Oregon's like, nah, 20 feet's fine. You know, and so imagine, and so you have to be out of these spray areas. You have to be out of there for so many minutes. So there's usually a migrant farm worker is in this tractor-like thing where he's spraying, you know, the herbicide or the pesticide, and then everyone has to stay away. So sometimes these family, you know, you're supposed to be indoors with a lot of them. So imagine you're in this little cabin, you know, with your family that has cracks and everything. Some of the branches of these trees are literally touching your house, right? And then you're supposed to be in there while they're spraying it, and it really offers no protection because it's not really good ventilation. And suppose you have to, you know, in the middle of this, you got to go take a leak, you know, and the bathroom's out in the middle of the, you know, kind of in the center of this wheel of homes. And so it's pretty terrible, you know,
yeah.
It's pretty terrible. And in Oregon, at least, when I went and spoke to OSHA about this a couple of weeks ago. And, when I was looking at the data that had been collected by OSHA to determine whether or not it was going to use the standards set by the EPA, all the data they collected was financial data based on how the farms would be impacted. And nothing about the human impact, which was, pretty terrible.
Yeah.
Put the least. And then, when the scientist was kind of explaining how things happen, she was asked point blank, what scientific data are you guys relying on to determine that it should be 25 feet, for example, instead of 100 feet? And her answer was, no data.
Oh, man.
So it's, it's just, you know, and I try to think about this. I think it's a similar theme. I know nothing about living conditions of first native people here, but for so many of us, we don't see them because there are so many are live on reservations, right? And so we don't think about them unless something, you know, happens with the pipeline last year, and I think when you don't see people, then you don't think about them, and so you don't worry about them, right? And yeah. I would say the same thing for Black Americans. If you live somewhere way up north. Let's pick on Utah for a minute, right? Not a lot of Black people in Utah. It's easy to dismiss the lives of Black people, and I would argue it's the same thing with migrant farm workers, that you really don't see them, you know, unless you go grocery shopping on a Sunday, which is when Hispanics tend to go grocery shopping, right? And these farm workers tend to go grocery shopping. You just don't see them. Your food just magically shows up, right? And the only time people think about the migrant farm worker is if there's an E. coli outbreak in, you know, broccoli or something, then all of a sudden everyone's upset.
But even then, I mean, I think that they're just it's a group of people that a lot of times don't want to be singled out or focused on. So they'll kind of, and I've kind of explained some of the reasons for that, but there are other reasons too. They estimate that 500,000, 400,000 to 500,000 farm workers are kids. In other words, and that means under 18. So it could be a 14-year-old, could be a 12-year-old, could be an 18-year-old, but they estimate that 400 or 500,000 are kids. And these are kids that, you know, if you were to ask them to stop working, and they'd say, well, my mom or my dad depend on the money that I make picking fields, so I don't want to. So it's almost like, oh, there's this terrific documentary that came out in 2011, or they just, it's called The Harvest or La Cosecha. And I think if we could put a link to it or something like that underneath, we could put a link to The Harvest of Shame if you're interested in the old stuff. And then the newer ones, The Harvest, which it talks to a couple young people who work in the farms, and it just kind of gives you an idea of what their living conditions are like and what their circumstances are like. And it's a tearjerker, man. Like you said, it's hard to really understand how tough it is for some people until you're exposed to it. You know, it's impossible to just kind of sit here. And I've tried to do a couple of thought experiments throughout this of like thinking about where the food came from or thinking about the occupational or physical hazards. But until you actually like see it and, you know, even participate in it to some degree, it's just impossible to truly understand. So I hope that, you know, La Cosecha is a good movie. There are a bunch of documentaries and movies about it, but I think if you want two that are really good, Harvest of Shame is interesting from an older perspective, and The Harvest is good from a new perspective.
Yeah, I found La Cosecha. I'll put that link, and I'll go look, and I'll put a link to The Harvest of Shame as well. I think what you brought up is important. You know, something that I obviously overlooked is that, I mean, you've brought it up over and over again, is that a lot of these, a lot of migrant farm workers want to be out of sight, right? They don't want to cause problems. They want to do their job. Their family depends on, you know, kids who are younger than 18, helping to provide for the family. So they just want to keep out of people's eyesight, you know, so they can live.
Right. And they don't want to make a scene. I don't blame them at all. Like, just think about the opportunity costs of making a scene about some injustice and then being discovered and then having your whole family deported just one interesting thing about that is thinking about immigration reform, and that a lot of people don't really care for immigration reform because they benefit from the current system as is. Let's say like every single farm worker that works on every single farm had to get paid a minimum wage or had to have workman's comp or some sort of insurance or something like that. Like a lot of these, probably the farm lobby is like, no, we can't have that. Like, so, you know, it's interesting that like the way that the immigration works and the way that farm work is happening right now, like it's almost like not in their interests to fix the system, because they're kind of, their model is built on a broken system.
Oh yeah, I see what you're saying. So, you know, like here, the companies here that the big farm companies here, because they benefit from that, you know. So monetarily, they're made wealthier. And but then at the same time, you have people in the current administration that makes everyone scared of the migrant farm worker, right? Of the immigrant. So
totally. So which comes still jobs that nobody wants to do.
Yeah. It's kind of, yeah, they're just getting, used for, again, by, you know, powerful and usually white people, right?
Yeah. And there is a legal work program called, and I mentioned that I'd bring it up and I want to get it before we move on. It's called the H-2A visa program. These guys will go down to some other country, a lot of times Mexico, sometimes Guatemala, and they'll say, hey, come to work in the United States for 6 months or 10 months or 11 months, and we'll pay you a standardized amount. So it's basically like a legal, you know, entre comillas, legal way to bring them here. But they'll just go to Google and look up H-2A mistreatment, and you're just going to see, like, they'll bring them here and sometimes they'll be treated really poorly. And a lot of farmers complain about it because they have to get audited periodically. So they'll like have people come and check the trailers and make sure there's not like holes in the wall, or they'll actually have to like keep everything tip top so that the government doesn't interfere. And so they're like, yeah, the farmers get really pissed off because they're like, I have to follow these government regulations in order to keep my farm going, because I'm trying to do the right thing, but it'd be so much easier if I could just do all this under the table like I used to.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, if you're curious, just go to Google and look up H-2A mistreatment or H-2A violations, and you'll see like there's a lot of situations where these guys come and things just really suck for them, and they're missing home, and a lot of them come as single guys. You can't really bring a family as an H-2A worker. So a lot of these guys are single guys, like, you know, sending all their money back home, and super lonely. And like a lot of people, when I used to work for the farm worker clinics, we do these sort of health outreach events for farm workers. And I used to always try to go to the H2A workers because despite the fact that they're, like I said, legal, just I don't like that term anyway, but they still were mistreated. They still had really crappy circumstances a lot of the time. And they're also kind of a forgotten population.
Yeah, that's an interesting point that you brought up. So I remember when I was at this OSHA meeting here in Oregon, and the very last person to speak was a farmer, a white farmer, and he got up and kind of contested everything that had been said, especially by the brown people, about the living conditions of the migrant farm workers. And he said that he's always taken care of his workers and stuff, which it could be true. It's probably true, right? But that doesn't, then he would be the exception based on what I've seen, you know.
Yeah,
my own eyes. And so I mean, yeah, okay, I'll believe you, but that doesn't mean everyone else is as noble
I had good relationships with farmers, and I had these guys that would say, you know, I treat them like my own family.
Yeah, that's exactly what this guy said. Yeah.
And it's like, okay, whatever. But there's still like this ridiculous power dynamic where you're like, you know, treat them like your own family. But if they stop working, then what are you going to do? You know, you're going to go all Yosemite Sam on them, you know? So yeah, it's, I think as much as I liked working with, you know, I like the farmers I worked with. They're not exactly like an easy crowd to get on good terms with because they're also super distrustful of the government and all that stuff. But there's still just a gnarly power dynamic which you just can't deny. So it can never be a family unless you're like you enslave your kids, basically.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, sounds reasonable.
It's like who hasn't done that to their kids? It's like your boss saying or anybody's boss saying, yeah, my employees like my family, but if you could fire your family or you could force your family to work overtime or, you know, whatever else. Exactly. It's like, daughter, I don't, you're making me mad today. You know, your role as my daughter is on the line. I'm just joking.
No. Well, my dad actually did that to me one time when I was at, like pre-kindergarten. I told a lie. And then he said that this is terrible. So I'm kind of laughing about it just because it hurts so bad. No, it doesn't hurt. It doesn't bother me anymore. But I told this little lie. I can't remember what it was. And my dad said, my sons don't lie. And I'm like, oh, okay, dad. No, you can't call me dad because my sons. So like he went a whole day where I couldn't call him dad.
Ugh.
What the hell? That's terrible to do to a kid. You know,
you can cut this out. But was he NPD?
ZMPD, I don't know what that means.
Narcissistic personality.
Oh, you know, he was never diagnosed with that, but he, you know, with my very little, psych training I had when I was in school, and that being, you know, 16 years ago, he would probably fit that profile.
There's just one thing I've heard a lot about folks that withhold affection, like as a way of punishment. It's just like such a horrible thing for a parent to do.
Yeah, it's pretty terrible. But yeah, you know, I survived, and I'm not a migrant farm worker, so I'm doing okay. I'm doing okay.
And I want to bring up something about that. There are migrant farm workers, and I'm not going to say they love the work they do, but it's just like it's what they do. Like, I've talked to these guys and they'll just say, yeah, I pick plants. Like, so yeah, it'd be nice to go back to college and get a degree in something, but they just don't see the opportunity. A lot of them have been doing it for decades and they're just like, look, this is what I do. I hope better for my kids, but I'm a farm worker. So and I think there should be pride. I used to tell my kids in these programs, like, the work that you guys, that your parents do, I'm like, I know some of you told me you're embarrassed that your dad and mom work in fields. I'm like, don't be embarrassed. Like, the world depends on them. Like, in such a huge way. Like, I wanted them to be prideful of the work that their parents did, because, you know, it's crazy to think, you know, there's that stupid, I didn't see it, but George Lopez or something movie about, like, what if all the farm workers disappeared or whatever. I don't remember what it was called, but it's just kind of harrowing to think about, like, what if every single farm worker just disappeared for like a month, like just no fruits and vegetables in the stores. Like, it'd just be crazy how disruptive that would be if we didn't, you know, if there weren't those. At the same time, you know, considering all of that, you're in this place where you're just like, well, I wouldn't wish that all the occupational hazards that come with it. I wouldn't wish the difficulty of the job on any human being, you know? So it's like this weird bridge that I have to walk, like, as an advocate, or I don't want to say, like, stop doing migrant farm work. But I also, like, I'd say, like, the best humane way to do it would be to say, like, make the conditions of farm work as optimal as they possibly can. That makes sense.
No, that does. Yeah. And that's a difficult thing, as an advocate or an ally or whatever, especially when, you know, us white people, we kind of want to tell everyone how to do their lives, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. You come in and you're just like, this is an outrage. Stop doing migrant farm work right now. And they're just like, look, you know, I don't need you to get outraged for me. I could just stop talking so loud.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, when you're talking about how most of these migrant farm workers just want to kind of be out of sight, when OSHA came, you know, there was a couple, you had to print your name and email address, if you wanted to approach the panel there. And, you know, a few of the migrant farm workers had, right? But by the time their name got called, they're like, no, I'm not going to do this. And then they left, you know. And at that time I was like, oh, that's a shame. But at the same time, I'm like, now, you know, speaking with you and getting a little bit more clarity on this, I understand that. You know, it could have been just, I don't like to speak in front of crowds. That could be it very well, because I bet you a lot of these migrant farm workers don't do that on a regular basis. But it could also just been a real, you know, real fear of something, especially when you're speaking to a government agency, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot. I feel like I feel like there's a lot of instability that people felt historically. And I feel like that is increased a lot over the last few years. You know, oh, yeah. Obama's deportation. I don't want to blame it all on Obama, but his administration's deportations and these ICE raids. Like, I can't think of anything more terrifying than just being chilling in my house after a day of working and then had there's basically like a SWAT team come and drag, you know, my family away. It's just like super, it's a violent thing that happens. So it's like, if you can like stick around and make an okay wage and send some of it home and keep your family going in Mexico, and there's this really crappy thing you have to deal with at work, but you don't, like, it's not so bad to you that you want to like risk everything on like testifying to committee or whatever else. Like, that's the kind of cost they have to make in their minds. Like, am I really going to like go and talk to this committee and be on a video camera and everybody's going to know who I am and see my face? Or why don't I just, you know, lay low and keep in the shadows, you know?
Yeah, it makes logical sense when you think about it from that perspective, as opposed to the perspective, you know, that you and I have. You know, we're white, we're males, right? And
right, it's kind of like you see the white fragility concept, where like we're inconvenienced in like the slightest way and we're like, this is an outrage.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. My rights are being trounced upon.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. I'm getting on the internet right now and complaining. You know.
Exactly, man. Exactly. All right, brother. Well, we're hitting up on an hour. Is there anything else you want to bring up? And maybe if there is, we can have you on again, because I've, you know, I do, you know, like I said, I work with a group that advocates, but I'm still, I mean, I'm super, super green at this. Like tomorrow, like I'm going to start teaching Spanish class or English classes and also citizenship classes. And so registration for that's tomorrow. And so I'll be there. I'll be doing that. And then I'll be doing the classes. But like I said, I'm totally new to this. So I would love if you came back on and we could talk about like some little minutia, some little piece of it and talk about that to kind of allow our listeners to understand, what life is like. Because, you know, most people that listen to this, I would say, are liberal. And so, you know, they get outraged, but they don't understand. And that's without actually seeing the life that these people live. Although they might, like, you know, one day go and see, you know, a migrant camp and then come back and be, oh, it's terrible. And that was their one, that was their one experience. That was a little bit of a bit of a ramble there. Sorry.
A podcast is like controlled rambling, so I think you're all right.
Okay.
I'd say, I mean, I don't even consider myself much of an expert on this. There are other people that know. They're doing like really great work in this. There are legal teams and lawyers and organizations like the National Center for Farmworker Health, and there's all sorts of great advocacy organizations all throughout the United States. What I would like to do is I can send you like a link dump of some just facts, really simple facts, like a couple different organizations that do farmworker advocacy and just ways you can get involved if you want to help and some different things like that, like some resources just in case people want to kind of further educate. And my information might be outdated, and if I've said anything that's be fact checked, then I feel I'm totally open to being corrected or provided more insight on.
No, this is good, because because you've been on the ground with this for much longer than I have. Sometimes I feel I just have like the new convert zeal, right? I'm just running around, but I'm not doing any good. I'm just pissing people off, because I'm like, it's like I just found Amway, right? Now I want to talk to everybody about Amway. Now nobody wants to talk to me.
But I just think there are a lot of groups that need to be better understood in the United States. I'm from Kentucky, and in Eastern Kentucky, in Appalachia, there are conditions that people wouldn't even recognize as being like in America. There are like health conditions, there are living conditions that are like the lowest of the low in Eastern Kentucky, and there are kids and families being brought up in it. So, when people bring up poverty in Appalachia, I'm like, somebody's finally advocating for poverty in Appalachia. So like, we all need to sort of have our eyes opened up to these groups that are suffering. Migrants, for me, are particularly bad just because in so many ways they're like their health outcomes, education of children, they're like, it's just so bad. But, I guess the more exposure we can provide for these different groups, like, the better.
Yeah, I agree. Because it humanizes everything, and it makes it. I'm gonna go on a little rant here again. It's so easy to blame a people or a group of people for a problem, as opposed to realizing how complicated a system is that's created this problem. So, for example, a lot of Donald Trump supporters are upset with immigrants, right? Well, you got to go. And then they'll bring up, every so often there's an immigrant that kills somebody. I mean, that happens, right? But then what happens is no one wants to look at the actual system that has forced, 130-pound, 5'4" Mexican or Guatemalan man to risk everything to cross a border to work here. What's going on, and so it's a big complicated question and big complicated system, but it's so much easier just to blame someone that's brown that doesn't speak English, you know?
Well, just in another soapbox that I won't go too far on, but it's just think about every single industry in the United States that there's it. We rely in capitalism on an underclass, which, you know, a lot of people talk about that, but every single industry, whether it's manufacturing or agriculture, there are people either in other countries that are doing it for pennies, or there are people in our own country, construction, you know, like, so many industries just rely on this underclass that will do the labor for super cheap, and it sucks. It sucks that you know, I can get a job and work at a desk or whatever and, like, not risk my life every day, but there are people that, like, literally risk their life every day for the work they do.
For sure.
You get paid way less than your average white guy.
Yeah. Yeah, those are, man, this has been really good for me. I hope the listeners have enjoyed it as well. It's, you know, like I said, I'm kind of learning about this, and so this has, you know, helped me, and definitely be a good, I'll bring this up during dinner tonight with my family. But yeah, we definitely have to have you back on. I'll keep my ears open, and then we'll have you come back on and come maybe as a regular co-host with me, where we can talk about this stuff. But before I let you go, Thomas, tell me the name again of that movie in the 1960s around
It was called Harvest of Shame. Harvest, it's all up on YouTube.
Oh, okay. It's
not really a movie. It's more like a 60 Minutes type thing.
Okay, but you can actually watch it on YouTube right now?
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay, cool. I'll link to it.
And then the other thing is called The Harvest, or La Cosecha.
Yeah, I saw that. That one I found. So I'll
Harvest of Shame. And there are scores of others. As a matter of fact, if any listeners are aware of the other documentaries or movies, then feel free to share those too.
Yeah, for sure.
There are lots.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thanks, Thomas. And if anybody has questions, you know, you can always send them to the link that's on the blog. It, you know, you fill it out right there, and it's an email that gets sent to us. And I could definitely, if you have a question for Thomas, we could definitely have him come back on, and he could answer that question. Or, you know, some of you know that you can also leave us a voice recording of the question. Those ones always make it onto the podcast, and then we could have Thomas back and deal with those questions directly from the listeners. But
yeah, I'd be happy to, and if I don't know the answer off the top of my head, I have lots of friends still in migrant farm work that can answer the question too.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Thomas. We've been talking about this forever, so I'm glad mm-hmm. we're finally able to do it. So thanks for your time, and thanks for your expertise and you know, the experience that you're able to bring a lot of this to the forefront of our minds. So
happy to talk about it, and hope it's been helpful.
All right, cool. Thanks, man. I'll let you. It's late where you live, so you better get to bed.
All right.
All right. See you, man.
Take it easy.
Bye.
That was not uncomfortable at all.
Nope.
Is that stuff true, Papa?
Outro music provided royalty free through bendsound.com.
The end.